is the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So here we are, just past solstice, quickening of democratic animism in all of our hearts, dreaming with the earth, which was a pretty splendid, playfully profound, if I do say so, Zoom celebration that I did with Amakayla Gaston and Sean Patrick O'Donohue. It's available for any amount donation, even zero, at coyotenetworknews.com. So there we go. So more than perfectly now, as we are dreaming with the earth, we welcome Andreas Korneval, prodigiously cultivated author, storyteller, and ecological activist. He grew up in South America, Sweden, and Switzerland, and now directs the Earth Restoration Service charity. In response to the ongoing sixth mass extinction, he was the catalyst behind the Life Care Movement, Memorials for Species Rendered Extinct at Human Hands. As a storyteller, he works with old myths and fairy tales which shine a torchlight on life's journey. His stories tend to gravitate around the Norse material, which have led him to lecture and perform in universities and educational centers. Through his charity, he has planted over 200 woodlands in the United Kingdom, and he has recently been voted by the University of Southern California as one of their 100 spiritual exemplars. Welcome, Andreas.
Oh, hello, welcome. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. This is great. There's so many things to address. And the solstice, and you're just returning from the hills celebrating the solstice, yeah?
It's true. Yeah, I was up on the hill, funnily enough, with a priest and a bunch of others. It was a great combination of kind of heathen and Christians coming together, celebrating and drinking mead under the big sky. So that was great.
Yes, right. Well, syncretism from your own background, you know, weaving these things. And one of the things we noted in our solstice is the New Orleans tarot voodoo came out a while ago. But I said to my friend Marcelino A. Santero, I said, they've done a marvelous syncretizing of Ifa and the Kabbalah and New Orleans voodoon, really marvelous. And he said, that's because they all started off together. And I love that idea that it all started off together and then the diaspora of many, many myths and traditions, and now they want to flow back in. Does that resonate with yourself?
That's exactly what it felt like, yeah. There's a form of reconciliation that is trying to pour into the cracks. A sweet mead is trying to get to us, yeah, to reconcile and to just have the good old virtues back of respecting each other and enjoying this short time we have here on this earth.
Yeah, I was listening to your podcast on Waking the Dragon and the alchemical symbol between opposing forces of the eagle and the serpent. And, you know, and you said integrating then the winged serpent and reconciling, you know, the dragon waking up. And I just wanted to, you know, decades ago, I was part of a project in Rhode Island of working with delinquent gang members, young kids, really, to guide them to non-economic forms of power. And the baddest of the bad guys, therefore the most lovable, really. And he was very like, and then he said, okay, I found, they were to find their animals. He said, I found my animal. It's a snake that lives 100 miles beneath the surface of the earth. And it was him. He was way back in there. And then he said, and this is like a 12-year-old kid, he said, and the snake sees an eagle soaring overhead, and they realize they have to get back together for the sake of all creation. We were like, whoa, this 12-year-old kid from a rough neighborhood with gang contracts on his life, not reading Jung, it was just in him.
Yes, and when you mention it, I also, exactly, reading Jung, I think it was James Hillman was quite the master of this soul and spirit concept. I took a lot of inspiration from him when it came to that alchemical move of joining that old worm, we call them. The serpent without wings are called worms or wyrms, W-Y-R-Ms. And they don't have wings, so they are usually very much in the undergrowth of things. But that move when the serpent and the eagle suddenly decide not to be at war with each other, it's a marvelous moment. That is sprinkled in quite a few of the Eddic stories, in fact.
Right. And then, you know, we're all, as we spoke backstage or texted backstage, yes, to slow down in order to speed up, right? To slow down so you can keep me slow and therefore responsive and not reactive. You know, and it's tricky that because so here we are, you know, all in this dream together, and we know that the submarine with five people on it had exploded and they found the wreckage. And it does resonate so much of humans, you know, spent in a recovery effort, you know, in contrast to the hundreds and hundreds of migrants who just drowned, you know, off the coast of Greece, I think. So there is that contrast, but I was dismayed to see, you know, some kind of progressive celebrities saying about those on the submarine, serve them right, those billionaires. And it's like, oh, no, you know, not react, but respond, you know, let us not lose kinship, even with the billionaires among us all in this dream. And I could feel myself getting reactive, and it's like, no, everything, all part of it, that we do extend grief. Maybe we speak about grief, so much of your dedication, you know, for the five people, for the hundreds and hundreds of migrants, and for the amount of mobilization that so often humans, you know, gather. I was at the beach when a swimmer got lost, and so much, you know, turned up to save him. Alas, they found his body. But it was like all that for one person. That's how it should be. But that's how it should be for everything, right?
Well, that's right. I think there's a saying. When I was doing the Life Can, we had this, well, I still do the Life Can, which is a memorial for extinct species, which is a grief project, really. And there's always this saying that all life to carry one life and one life to carry all life. And that was the motto, that was the chant that we had amongst the stones that we built for extinct species. And it became that chant, that song became stronger and stronger the more we did it. And the more we understood, yeah, one life to carry all life to carry one life.
Yeah,
And
again.
that includes a lot of species and a lot of different identities, whether you're a billionaire or anything else. Those things, like you say, they are a phenomenon, really. The true thing is what's inside of those people, and those were five souls that we lost.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, and you know, well, we we empathize. I mean, for those of us who find a fly swimming in the pond and take it and swim it to shore, right? It going, it could be me. It could be me. Just that sense of, you know, where can we be helpful? Where can we be kind? I love. I've done the sky map of where we are in DC, where everybody is listening, many people listening in Berkeley, and where you are. So right out your window is a fantastic thing. I don't know if you had to come in to see it, but Venus and Mars and the Moon are all setting in the west where you are. They're rising in Berkeley now, but they're setting where you are in England. Did you get a chance to see this glorious
I
show?
haven't seen it yet, but I'll definitely go out after this and have a look. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
Yeah.
it's beautiful. It's all in Leo, again, humans gathering for ceremony, and it squares Uranus in Taurus, whose image is a white dove flying over troubled waters. And so it's part of your great dedication, which is let us gather and celebrate, you know, on behalf of the earth. You know, it's not performance, it's dedication.
And it's interesting when we did the Life Can grief rituals, we're always so surprised how it became almost an ecstatic dance or song afterwards, because something had been there was some shackles that had been lifted, something that was bound had been freed, and that was something that we were all very surprised about, how suddenly that regenerative spirit came out from the stones, even though the stones represented the real harrowing facts of our presence on Earth, you know, the sixth mass extinction, one of the
Yeah,
man-made ones.
and your profound dedication to the power of of myth, because part of what is before us all, it's Mercury, our voice, you know, the one planet in air right now at a square 90-degree angle to Neptune, dreams, vision, imagination, fairy tales, the fairy world between worlds. And it says, you know, what you're doing, right, which is to be a voice for that. But it says, you know, either connect our minds to mythology, or we'll have the toxic mimic of mythology, which is bamboozling, hoodwinking celebrity.
Exactly. So, and in particular, the question of identity, what we are, how we identify these celebrities, and with what, and they create a certain lifestyle that we have bought into. But I think this is something that is deeply magical, and it can be worked with. It's a form of perception that we have. I see that with my young girls. They are, you know, they go onto TikTok, like the teenage girls I have, or other, all these social medias. And there's a certain strange magical thing that happens, in the sense that they follow a current, and then they're taken over by a lifestyle. It's very manipulative, very difficult to stop.
Right. But I mean, you yourself are kind of dedicated to the antidote, to snap out of the trance, you know, and, yeah, you know, but it's true. It's humbling, you know, even your own kids. Well, all of us, really, the part of us that is like your kids, that can be, you know, addicted to the trance. You talk about the blue screens and all. And at this time where we really want to make all of our participatory skills available to us, I was poring over your splendid Instagram account, as well as Facebook, and so much, you know, but I loved, well, everything, but talking about the alphabet, the most powerful symbols we possess are our letters. You know, our alphabet contains 26 phonetic letter glyphs. These glyphs have built our world, everything that you know, and all knowledge leans on them. And then you say it's not so much the images, but the meaning the letters produce, that's secondary. You say it's the shape of the letters themselves.
That's right. Yeah. And sometimes we forget the power of the letter, because when we immediately come in contact with it, we form images. So we lose our awareness that the magic happens within the letter itself. And obviously within, this is something that happens in the old medieval grimoires, with angelic signatures and all of these things, as you know, including planetary ones, that they're made to give us an image that then in effect invokes or gives us a reason or a sign of that we see. And we do exactly that when we read, but at the current technology of writing that we have, we are missing the corporeal, we are missing the rhythmical, and we are missing the echoes of the natural world. So when we are reading texts, the corporeal and the rhythmic world isn't quite there. It's much more, we have mastered information, we have mastered utility in the way that we are using writing technology. And I would say that in my rune practice, for those who are interested in runes, in my rune practice, I'm attempting to make markings, symbols, more corporeal, less policing, and then to bring back the language that it actually to its origin. And when you bring back the language to its origin, you write, you are there with nature's own writing. And nature's own writing is, of course, what gave us the runes. It comes from the ash tree. You know, the Chinese letters comes from the back of a tortoise shell. And you can, when you go back to the mythic origin of languages, it comes from the earth itself. So in our way of reading, I think we have to start reading and writing, almost create a post-literary movement. And that is to, I think that is to also to access the symbols again, to access the signatures again.
So do you handwrite?
I do. Yeah, I do. I have a practice on some old rice paper where I do attempt to put ink on either a swan feather or something, where I can have a more of a physical experience of the writing process. Yeah. But I don't do it enough, having said
that. Ah, right. Well, there's so many things. And then, you know, things that we gather along the way and keep with us, you know, like magic stones in our pocket. And when I was lucky enough to be in Syria, and we went to the souk in Aleppo, and the calligrapher, who was at first grumpy, but then we won him over. And he did this wonderful thing. He wrote beautiful healing words from the Quran with vegetable ink on rice paper, and then he put it in our tea so we could drink the words. I go, oh, I love that. I love drinking the words.
They trace, when they make holy water, they trace the cross with salt. They trace the water with salt, don't they? It's something about tracing over water, tracing letters over water. Mm. There is definitely something there that you can experience in when you're doing image making or journeying and things like that, tracing a rune across the river, or seeing a rune across the river, or in particular in the barks of trees. Because in a way, I find that you may not understand what the tree is saying in the sense that we understand what the letters are telling us, but everything that is there has poetic significance. So it cannot be empty of meaning. Everything has a tremendous meaning. So there is thousands of years of standing under trees and learning what language they speak, because they are filled with meaning in every single sense. And that's the great weird. That's the great web, which is so vast. But in a way, I find that when I see the movement of the branches, I can recite that stanza of Odin when he hangs in the ash tree, and when suddenly he picks up the runes, he sees the language of the holy tree.
Hmm.
He feels it probably.
So language and even the alphabet, and not just the English alphabet, but all alphabets, I thought of that. So might we think of it as one of the earliest, first great technologies of participation?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
And in keeping with what you said just a couple of paragraphs back, I also keep in my heart, you know, when Chief Marie, head of the Athabascans in Alaska, a friend of many, when she was dying, she was one of the last Athabascan speakers, and her tribe was worried that they would lose the language. And she got very fierce in a good way, and she goes, no, the language comes from the earth. And if you maintain your connection to the earth, it will bubble back up.
Hmm. That's such a relief to hear that, isn't it?
Right. Well, yeah. And then you have many, many great things to try. Like I have somewhere in the notes, but I'll leave the notes behind. But you say there's a practice that you've been leading of, it starts with you, but it's where you make a promise or a vow to walk at night in the woods for a year. Right.
Oh, the Uttasitta, yes, exactly, the Uttasitta, yes. Which is a marvelous thing, really, because we know so in Northern European culture there's so many scant sources. They're not many. They're few and far between. But sometimes something shows up like the Uttasitta, which is, I mean, it's a very similar idea to the, obviously, to what we're used to hearing with Vision Quest. You go out and look for meaning, look for a vision, look for power, look for all kinds of things. And the Uttasitta, the way that we understand it, comes from laws, early medieval laws, 12th century laws, which forbade people from doing this practice. It was a kind of anti-pagan laws in effect. And the practice was that you would sit on a mound or on crossroads, and you would look for an answer. You bring out the questions that is within you, and you take it out to the crossroad or to the mounds. Now, so many people did this that they were literally would be arrested sitting down. So what happens in order to get away, they people started to walk at night instead. And that came with the idea of the Orshgong, which is where you walk for an entire year and you walk at night and you look for answers, for divination, for all kinds of reasons. And so these different laws now that I've looked into these sources, they really point towards a practice, a real ancient practice that existed in certainly in northern Europe.
Yeah, no, I'm up for that. I'm up for that. I often walk the dogs at night and sort of woods-ish. You know, there are woods close by, and then there's a little bit. So even a micro woods will count, right? Again, if we are making our deal,
like I do myself. I love the micro woods. I have exactly that experience every night. Yeah, taking my dog for a walk in the woods.
Oh, that's great.
Right. So. I can do that. I can do that about for a year. Are you in the middle of your year of walking at night or not quite?
No, not quite. I mean, I find that the practice, the actual, whether we would call it choreography or how it was practiced, we don't exactly know in a sense of what you would do during this time. But what it was essentially there for is for other worlds to be in communion with other worlds, or when other worlds can be heard and understood. So often dusk hour was the time when that was appropriate. Or dawn would be another one where you would go up. Or you encounter something which is not a teacher, not a human teacher. So it's not sort of knowledge you go to a university. It's not knowledge you go to find, like I mentioned just before, maybe you go to listen to the river or sit under the trees and find that you are there to look for knowledge which is outside of just a human bound knowledge. So
I love that.
So that's what we're investigating, of how that can be revived now in the modern, you know, how we can revive it without. It can be done. I find the Utesitta, the power of it now is that it can be done with lots, or a lot of our imaginations can be used for this. We can use our imagination to figure out how we can create a revival of the Utesitta again.
Yeah, no, I have I urge people to go to Andreas Korneval's Instagram as well as website, where I have lifted with attribution your Utesitta Crossroads drawn pictured here. It's beautiful, and I'll be, you know, posting that again with attribution and guidance. So you say you've been working on the Utesitta Crossroads stave, traditionally drawn for contemplative use while sitting on a crossroads. You said at New Year's, but we will, you know, and then you with your people who are lucky enough to be local to cavort with you, we will investigate rune stave designs like this and how they can become amplifier glasses in seeing parts of ourselves. And then you have this beautiful drawing. That's really great.
That's right. Yeah. These symbols or staves, they're often called the Icelandic stave tradition is quite a late one. It's a sort of 17th century practice, but obviously influenced by either hermetic practices. You can see the similarities between some of the Icelandic rune staves and the hermetic signs and symbols, but it has its own distinct design. You can also see that there is another thing going on there, and I think that's the influence of the much older runic current. And when you go out into an Utesitta, often the language that people come back with is something of an oracular language. You know, we talk about often in this practice, we talk about the unbidden image, you know, that arrives with someone. So, you know, when you become surprised, like, why am I seeing a white horse in my mind running over those red roses or red rivers? So these images then are often used to become symbols that lead our investigations or lead our discoveries. That's the magnifying side of it, that our language goes deeper into our unconscious language, becomes more unbidden, more imaginative and bigger in effect.
Yeah, I know these rituals that sort of support our daily lives. I love just a simple one because I also love the astrological glyphs. So we have a 7-day week because of seven visible planets. So, you know, today is Thor's day, you know. So every day with cornmeal, I go out in front of my house and I make a little cornmeal glyph of the planet for that day. And I love that because the birds come to eat it and you get reminded. And then neighborhood children are like, are you practicing witchcraft? I'm like, well, you know, that'll do, but this is something you could do too, you know. That, and they're like, oh, can we study? But yeah, and then just backwards to what you said, wonderful storyteller Gioia Timpanelli, keeper of Sicilian stories. She says one of the openings is, there's five ways of traveling, walking, crawling, swimming, flying, and how we go now. Ooh. And then she says, dusk or twilight, you know, is the most magic time because it's neither night nor day. It's where everything can happen. And I go, ooh, we love these, you know, guiding us little goosebumps into mystery, going, ooh. Yeah, and that call and response, right? This, you know, which,
the great, I mean, you know, wonder, the great storyteller. Yeah, and good friend also, Martin Shaw in his School of Myth down in Devon. I'm sure you've come across him. He's a tremendous storyteller.
I knew him when people didn't know him.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when he started off in his tent, yeah, and it was interesting because in those beginning times, I remember those times. There was the dusk, always regarded as the hour of between the dog and the wolf.
Yeah. Yes. Right, and he lives on the edge of Dartmoor, and I remember a million years ago going to Dartmoor, and the advice was to turn your clothes inside out before you stepped onto the moor, as a gesture of respect or reversal magic, really, so that the pixies and elves wouldn't lead you into quicksand. And I like that. I mean, I like these small things that are not superstition; they're really dedicated play. You know. But that's great, and I've forgotten where it is that you live. Where are you?
I live in Brighton. I live on the Brighton, south of England.
Yes, yeah, Sussex. Wonderful.
Yeah.
So no, it's the confluence of all the storytellers and all of that. And then, you know, when you go forth, are entheo sacraments part of your diet?
There has been. There is definitely that. Absolutely. There is the teacher. There's a famous teacher of the Flyer Jarek, of course, the Red Cap. He tends to be a fierce teacher, so one has to tread carefully. Very fierce. Yes. I did a lecture once, in fact, on this at the Psychedelic Society, and I said I spoke about great lengths of ibotenic acid and muscimol and all of these things, and one of the things that is known for is that when you consume something like that or when you work with something, it you often hear bells at your chest area or in your heart area. You hear the sound of bells. And I said this whilst giving the lecture as a side note, you know. And then there's an old, very much older man, he came up to me afterwards and he looked at me and he said, you know, I've been wondering about this for 40 years, those bells. And now I understand what it was. And it was, I think it was part of the in the reason why it's often called the soma was the Flyer Jarek, is that it sort of closes the base chakra and it opens up the heart chakra. For a moment, you are not driven by your sort of desires, and therefore the bells ring in the heart. And that's something that and of course this deeply, deeply traditional mushroom is part, certainly very firmly rooted in Sami culture in particular, which is more the reindeer, the reindeer culture up north. Yes. But right. For those of us who were a bit further south, the Utesita again, there's another word for it called Finnfara, which is when you would travel to the Finns in brackets, and the Finns were the Samis, and where you would receive knowledge to bring back to your community. So the Samis were always regarded as the keepers of hidden knowledge.
Right.
So to go Finnfara would mean to go and see and meet them.
And it was James Arthur, you know, mycologist, who first told on this show the story of Christmas as an Amanita mushroom festival, which is quite compelling. Yeah. But then he got into trouble with that sacrament, as some people do. So are you talking about Amanita when people hear the bells?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Ah. So there is the trouble is the Red Cap. So he's regarded as the the red cap teacher.
Little red cap spirit.
We'll come right back to this. We're going to take a very short break. Our splendid guest today is Andreas Korneval, a prodigiously erudite, a mythological ally, and pragmatic mystic. His website is korneval.com, K-O-R-N-E-V-A-L-L. And we will be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his torus cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Ooh, chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. You can find our summer solstice Zoom Dreaming with the Earth. It was pretty great. You know, sometimes you do things and you go, and sometimes if it's really bad, you go, but sometimes when it's good, it's like it's better than it is. And it was. It's part of our all kind of working backstage to create the atmosphere conducive to the desirable. So it was me with two wonderful accomplices. I like the word accomplice, Sean Patrick O'Donohue and Amichaela Gaston. And you can find that for a donation of any amount, even a penny, at coyotenetworknews.com. So we're back with Andreas Korneval, a prodigiously cultivated author, storyteller, ecological activist. You planted 200 forests? Wait, right? What? 200 woodlands?
How did that happen? We did. Yes, we did. Funnily enough, I was a tree planting was my great passion, and whenever I used to call up local councils and landowners and things, they didn't really want to hear much about my ideas. So I was confronted with a dilemma that people didn't really want to have woodlands at the time when I started the charity. They didn't want to restore and all of these things. It was a bit of a pushback. So what I did is I said, look, why don't we plant tree nurseries inside schools? And the kids do it. The kids take care of the tree nurseries inside the schools. They learn about the trees. They learn about how this whole cycle works. And what happens then when I call the councils and the government advisors, all of these people, I said to them, look, there's a school here with 200 children. They have saplings. They want to plant a forest in the local community. Can we do this? And I have never had a no for an answer. From that moment on. So I did. So we did tree nurseries inside schools here in the UK, but also we've done also in India and other places around the world, but mainly here in the UK. And as a result, 200 woodlands have been planted. Yeah, since we started.
So did you always feel
sanctuaries?
Oh, no, that's so wonderful. Did you always feel from really your first breath that like I've got a mission? I don't always know what it is, but I know I have one.
Well, it's funny that I was driven by the very sort of the simplicity at the time of just doing guerrilla planting, which I love, which is basically doing what seeds do, planting trees where they belong, the appropriate trees. And it was really something that came quite naturally to me, and setting up a charity made it, I would say, a bit more of a container of making something more than just guerrilla planting, it's been going for a long time now, and it's not stopping. I just had a little video back from a school in India who I've seen the great trees. The trees that we planted there are now really big. This was about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and they are creating shade in the school, which I thought was lovely. because in India, especially in certain areas, it's so hot, you know, and the kids go to school. And now they have a wonderful area where they play, and they are shaded by these great trees.
Yes.
So yeah, I got today. That was a wonderful thing.
Well, we want everyone to connect with everyone. I will send you links to a show from 2 weeks ago with Diana Beresford Kroger, who is Tree Woman. She was orphaned in Ireland at a young age and raised by eccentric Druid aunts and uncles who taught her Druidic tree lore. And then she came to this country and got multiple science and medical degrees, right, to scientifically prove Druid tree lore. And now she has a Noah's Ark of trees in Canada. What I loved about her and also your dedication is that she's, you know, surrounded by fire and everything, but she is, and we're really in the danger time now, but she's full of, you know, rousing, informed, we can do this. We can do this, right? Mm. And you also have an informed, jaunty heart, right?
Mm. The way to grow forest is through remembering. That's say in the northern myth, there's the well of memory, and the well of memory is filled with our memories, of course, and the memories of those who've passed. And if they are remembered, there is water that forms in that well called the Ur, A-U-R-R, is a kind of a clay type of water, and that water feeds the roots of the tree of life. And in a way, you could argue that it feeds the roots of trees, right? It feeds our ecosystems. But forgetting causes drought, because by forgetting, the well dries up and the tree of life suffers. So forgetting is we all accused of it, we all do it, you know. But ceremony then is an important point of departure or point of place where you actively remember in order to replenish the well. And in doing so, you feeding the roots of what's called Yggdrasil, or the tree, the great tree of life, the anima universalis, which all trees are connected to. It's the great cosmic tree. Yeah.
Hmm. Right. And then, you know, I think it's a write up to another show you were doing. Techno animism, I think. You write, what kind of world is possible when we engage with the beings of the world, including our technologies, and when we acknowledge their aliveness? Can we give them ontological dignity? You write, some of this is happening already with the Shinto tradition in Japan. Well, it's in our hearts, right? I mean, it's how children relate, and it is one of my, you know, great dedications that we're all sharing, really, of democratic animism, which is so it's also, you know, oh tree, where do you want to be, right? That sense of that we do have a sense of call and response and where things want to go, and that sense of symmetry and aesthetic.
Yeah, exactly. And feeding that which feeds us. I sense that there is a very much a new form, syntheology, you know, the synthetic gods that people are trying to build through artificial intelligence. All of these things are very, very new frontiers. But giving it ontological dignity, or giving it at least the creating a relationship with it, is absolutely necessary in order for it to have an ethical dimension. I'm working around that at the moment. But it's a very difficult question of how we can, what that relationship should look like.
Well, wonder sort of takes us there, right? I mean, the one of the great kind of encouragements of the sky dance right now says, oh, humans, let's dissolve all certainty. There we are, because it was always a booby prize, you know. And the backstage gods are going, look, they've lost all certainty. Now they're available to mystery. A round of ancestral applause. That's so wonderful. And part of the beauty of what's being proffered to us is this call and response, wonder. I wonder, oh, what wonder attracting augury. You know, I wonder where the, oh, there we go. Because we know, or I know, you know, sometimes we call out going, hello, hello, you know, and there's nothing coming back. And, you know, but sometimes we call out and it's like, hello, and it's like, hello, Andreas, hello. You know, that there is a response that you know very well from place, from the power of place, from, you know, and then offering yourself, you know, what wants to happen here.
Yes, so, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah, right. Well,
No, no, you go. We have a teensy lag.
I'm thinking in relation to the goddess Techne she said that she would create things if they have an ethical, a good function, and I'm wondering how we are. If we are not feeding Goddess Techne, if we're not having a relationship to her, whether she starts to, whether we start to then feed instead with our, what are they, all these dopamines that we give our technology, all the chemicals, all the attention that we give it, and also the addictions and all of those sides of it. So we are feeding it the wrong things. We are giving the wrong libation to Goddess Techne, something like that.
Well, wait, let's say more. I mean, what is the libation that we are, the reality police would have us do, and what would be a real libation to the Goddess Techne?
But this is a great question that I'm sitting with. I'm looking for the answer, Caroline. I am absolutely wondering this question. This has been, you know, in my mind for a couple of months now. It's not coming easy what that libation is. But the ethical dimension that she mentions, that her work needs to be surrounded by a certain use, is therefore giving it a recognition and dignity. So not throwing the laptops in the bin, not hating our iPhones, but actually going closer to the shrines with them. And what happens when we do that? What becomes to our relationship then? But it's a very difficult image for me to entertain, because I'm always a reactionary against technology. You see, so it's hard for me to see it in that light.
But here we are. I found you on Facebook. I mean, there are many places to find you, but those of us not lucky enough to live in your neighborhood. Right. Yeah. Well, it's quirky, and then I love Martine Prechtel, kind of related to Martin Shaw. They don't know each other, but they're almost too similar to meet. But I love Martine saying, "Well, we speak about human manners. May our species have manners again." And he says, "Was the oil invited to come out of the ocean? Was the oil invited to become plastic? Was the plastic invited to become a computer?" You know, no. So that invitation, that kind of manners part, and I like that, and then they rebel. My favorite computer tech person is very animistic. She does a little bow before the computer, and if it starts to act up, she's like, easy, easy. No, there you go. There you go. Here we are. We're partnering. We're dedicated to a good thing. I think it's a good experimental way to go. You know, and then there's the goddess Techne. That's great. So, because I think you were interviewing.
How would you see the a ceremonial invitation to something like a social media network? I mean, how would you start to unknot all of those things? It's a very peculiar question.
It is.
I'm thinking out loud as I'm saying it.
It is. No, that's good. No, well, because we're all wondering. I do know that, you know, that the whole realm of atmosphere, you know, is a great backstage realm of participating to create the atmosphere conducive to the desirable. And when there's a conundrum, you know, so much, you know, vituperative polarity, and we want to cool it out. So something may. Trickster councils and I have been playing, experimenting, you know, believe nothing, you know, entertain possibilities and experiment. So we like brewing a psilocybe lavender mist to waft over any hot conflagration, you know, with the blessing, you know, may anything up to no good fizzle like a wet firecracker fart. And that seems to be working pretty well. And in the same way, I think we're all thinking out loud here in this experimental realm, but the idea of dedication, you know, that we form these partnerships, even with, you know, the microphone we're using and the wonderful, board op, hello, and the computer itself going, yes, may you be dedicated to goodness and kinship. And I think maybe it's, however it hums in each one of us what we want to do, and, you know, the way we turn the computer on. But it is addictive. And with language, I like to keep playing. You know, people talk about their addictions, and I go, well, what if you replace the word addiction with dedication, and then find out what it's really for? Like, I'm a sex addict. Oh, I'm dedicated to sex. And we go, well, find the dedication and work your way out. You know, it's kind of like etymology. It's like, dig back into the original liberating impulse behind, you know, what did this want to be before it got bamboozled or hoodwinked or whatever? What did this spark of technos want to be? You know, and Paul Stamets, great mycologist, says he thinks the mushrooms created the internet to help save the world. And I go, I like that. I like that. But do you ever stay too long on the computer, and then, you know, spirits or animals, in my case, my dogs, pull me away?
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's how I'm saved as well. I get my dog to start howling, but I do find that there is a discipline which is hard in our, because it's emergent, right? So for younger people, this idea of a discipline, of limit, of time, and all of those things probably is what Goddess Techni, in a sense, would have had us to consider through her work. But I don't know enough of Goddess Techni in order to really comment on it. But I'm certainly going to try and investigate her.
Well, it's like with any of these things, you know. Let's bring in Saturn, you know, which is what are we calibrated or dedicated to want to send and receive, you know, and heading into the Dartmoor of technology, where it does require some obeisance and that wonderful word chronophragic, which means time eating. Going, oh my God, I've been sitting here for 3 hours on this and that. Some value, but not as much as walking in the woods at night. So the dedication before venturing into the technological woods, you know, going, because I mean I see you're on Instagram and using it extremely well, and I'm still hanging in on Twitter because there's still a community of useful things, but to go in with the kind of our dedication is our protection, our dedication is our freedom, and finding our dedication to may it all be liberating. You know, you spoke on the Mythopoetic School podcast about Trickster, although I thought identifying Trickster as your host did just with Mercury and Gemini a little limiting, but you brought up Lewis Hyde, Trickster makes the world go round, which is a wonderful ally, and we taught together at Robert Bly's Great Mother Conference.
The trickster is a fundamental to all northern myth. When the trickster is bound, all hell breaks loose. Right? That's right. When all the trouble begins.
Right. Well, you'd brought up in that you brought up Loki, and right. Thor's hammer, which I don't know enough about. But there's a particular pattern in astrology called Thor's hammer, and I said to my great astro friend Sylvia Henley, couldn't we find a jollier name? But then I went online to look at Thor's hammer, and one of the many qualities, it said Thor's hammer can sweep corruption out of the halls of governance. I'm like, oh, let's keep that. That's a good idea.
Yeah, there is also in the creation myth, there's a great mill in Polaris on the polar star. And this great these great millstones are carried, the seven giant maids that are grinding these millstones, and when they are grinding the millstones, the bodies of giants are pushed into them, and they start making worlds out of the flesh of these giants, right? And Thor's hammer is called Mjölnir, which actually means a milling stone. So it represents these great millstones on Polaris, which of course also move the entire galaxy. So when they look up on a Polaris, they see that everything else moves around Polaris. So one of the symbols of the Thor's hammer is that fragments comes from those millstones, and that it creates order. So movement creates order. And so there is a secret there where the dwarves make the hammer of Thor. And I'm sure that one of the ingredients is that great millstone on Polaris. And it's from that great millstones that the creation happens. So it has a very important significance. The hammer is a form. We still use it in the court of law. You know, when you put hammer onto the desk, that is something of an ancient sort of order against chaos. You know, in fact, that's what you shout out, right? Order, order,
order.
So the hammer still symbolizes that, erecting order in the middle of a hurricane.
Yes, and is what you were just referencing, is that from a wonderful book, Hamlet's Mill?
Hamlet's Mill. That's I know of the book. I don't think I've read it, but I haven't either.
It's on my shelf. A book I keep meaning to read.
It's on my shelf.
It's important.
It is something that comes from It is much more of a myth and legend. From a man called Donald Mackenzie. He wrote about Norse myth in the 1930s, which is usually the best writing on Norse myth, because they were very elaborate and full of images, their retellings. And that's, I think, where I got it from. But of course, it also alludes to the idea that Polaris was the first star that the gods put into the great abyss. That was the first star.
That's great. All of that is great. I love that we both have that book on our bookshelves, awaiting to be read. But they're humming now. They're alive, going, we're here. We're here. We're on Andreas's bookshelf and Caroline's bookshelf. That's great. So again, you know, the one way I think of, you know, Neptune, the intelligence of dreams and vision, is as though, when it first entered Pisces, which is what have we forgotten that we must remember, and the way the image came is as though all the critters, all of the flora, fauna, fungi, meet backstage and go, what are we going to do about the humans? We got to either kill them or heal them. Let's do both. But let's make everything that has ever moved humans to participatory goodness available for fresh expression. And that's really what one of your great embodied dedications, right, to bring the usefulness of these myriad beautiful traditions of how can we have manners and cooperate and the whole realm of respect and animism to together. Because without that, I mean, with that, you know, with that animistic collaborative magic, it's like Diana Beresford Kroger. It's like, if we cooperate with the trees, then we can do it. If it's just us humans alone, it's hopeless, right?
Yeah. And we just speak with each other. Yeah. So we lose the other languages. We lose the language of rivers and the trees and the runes that we spoke of. The natural sigils that come from the earth. We've absolutely. Reconciliation is at the heart, of northern myth. For those who don't know this, but there was a great war in northern myths, and the war was between the sky gods and the nature spirits. They were at each other's throats, right, all the time, and they decided to make a truce, to make peace. But the peace then there was a great vat that came out, and they had to spit and weep into this vat and talk about the horrors of conflict and the wars that they've gone through for all the eons. And it was through that water from their spit that something started to grow in this vat. And that was what they call the pinnacle of creation, which is wisdom. And wisdom supposedly has not yet come to Middle Earth, to our place where we live. We are still fighting between the sky gods and the nature spirits are still fighting, right? But in the world of the gods, they have found a form of reconciliation. So that sharing between these two tribes is something that you can read about in the Poetic Edda and in the Prose Edda. And it is absolutely at the heart of something very beautiful, because there is peace there. Often we think of Vikings and that culture as sort of, you know, pirate types. But there was, at the very center, was the idea of reconciliation in order for wisdom to be born. Otherwise, wisdom cannot be born. So without reconciliation, it isn't possible to see it.
Right. And one of the great, I like to play linguistically. So many people, we use fight a lot, and we use struggle. I've been struggling with this issue, you know. And I go, well, what would it feel like if you replaced the word struggle with dancing? I've been dancing with this issue. It's like, oh, there's some movement. It might be a tango. There's whatever the thing is. And, you know, the again, back to where we began, you know, the power of language and alphabet as living, as partners. You know, so, you know, we're not going to, you know, fight. We're not gonna fight climate change. That's very hot. That's what got us into this pickle. We're gonna, you know, humans humbly cooperating with nature's guiding genius. But on our way out, the sun today quintiles beautiful 72 degree angle to Chiron, the entire tradition of mentors, and says, you know, the earth mentors. So, is there any mentor, animal, plant, human that you want to shout out to or invoke as we are in our last minute here?
I'll do a short prayer to the great tree.
Yes.
I'll do a prayer in Old Norse to the great tree. Mm. It goes like this. En ask vetekstanda, heter Yggdrasil, harbadmus invita orin, sadan koma dögvar taur sidala falla, stender Eofir grön I jordi brunni. It basically translates as, a great tree I know stands, a high tree, tangled in starlight, and from her come all the dew that falls in the valley, and she stands forever green over the well of memory.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much. I hope this is part one of more explorations. Thank you so much, Andreas Cornaval. Cornaval.com is his website. Marvelous, marvelous, marvelous. Thanks always to wonderful Kirsten Thomas Bordop. I'm Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com. And we will reconvene next week with Nestor Makhno and the Ukrainian anarchists. Woof. Bye.